And this is Bob Segal. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you have this fear that if God-fearing people get their act together and have their way, your civil liberties will be in danger. Indeed, you'll find yourself living not under a democracy, but a theocracy, a cross on a hill today. Police at your door tomorrow, forcing you to read the Bible. Well, if you feel this way, you may be in agreement with my special guest, Mark Thomas. Possibly not. He may not be exactly that extreme, but we'll find out. We'll let him speak for himself. An atheist who debated me once before live here in San Diego, but who joins us on our radio program for the first time. Now, Mark is a nice guy. I want to say that, even though we're going to have a debate. And I am happy to have him on our program to express his views, because we believe here in free speech. We believe that it never hurts to hear both sides. And Mark and I have very little in common other than the fact that we both love Star Trek. The last two people I debated, that was true with Dr. Price also. At least we agree on Star Trek. But you don't have to be a Star Trek geek to get along with me. Case of point, I get along great with my charming co-host, who is a little less enthusiastic about Star Trek and science fiction than I am. Say hello to Sharon Couchard.
You don't know me very well.
You're not as much
as
Star Trek.
I love Star Trek, the very first with Dr. Spock.
Well, Sharon,
and then it went downhill.
I'm including The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. I am not including Voyager, because the captain talked like an elf. Whoops, speed ahead, Mr. Chakotay.
The other little faux pas in that is you're not a geek, because to be a geek, you have to like be really good with computers, and you are not good with computers.
I'm not good with computers, so I'm not a geek. And I don't go to Star Trek conventions, and I don't wear costumes. I do like Star Trek, though. Well, we have a special guest today, and we're going to bring him on in just a couple of moments, but there's something hot off the press you wanted to refer to first.
I did, and we started talking about this the very last minute on KCBQ.
KCBQ, so you want some time to give it its just due.
I think so. I think this is good news.
We didn't do it justice
on
Q.
No, we didn't.
So we're going to do it justice on Z.
Right.
Go for it. This
is news that I think that our Christian audience would be very interested in. It's a lawsuit that Cassioli in Italy is lodging against his friend Ricci. Both of them are priests. They're both 70 years old. And Cassioli is saying that he's breaking two Italian laws. The first is abuse of popular belief meant to protect people against being swindled or conned. And since he's a priest, he writes in the parish newspaper, and the claim is that he's trying to trick people. And then the other crime that is being committed here is impersonation. And what Cassioli says is the church constructed Christ upon the personality of John of Gamala, referring to the first century Jew who fought against the Roman army. So there's going to be a lawsuit against his friend who represents the Roman Catholic Church to say that Jesus is not real, he never existed, it's all fake.
Of course, Jesus is an authenticated person from history, even from documentation and historians outside of the Bible. Many of you may contest that, including our guest.
Yes, and let me introduce Mark. Our guest today is Mark Thomas. He's an atheist. He's the California Assistant State Director for American Atheists. He's the advisory board member on Godless Americans Political Action Committee. He's co-founder and president of Atheists of Silicon Valley and steering committee member San Francisco Atheists. Mark, you were raised as a Methodist and became an atheist at about 19. Would you tell our audience a little about your change of heart?
Sure. Sean, hi. How are you?
Hi, good.
Hey, Mark,
thank
it's
you.
Nice to talk to you again. Thanks
good,
for coming
good
on
good
the
to
program.
Good to talk to you again. Yeah, it was pretty simple. I just in college, I just happened to notice a dead squirrel and realized that we are just as mortal as any other living being on this planet. It was no big revelation to me. It seemed pretty big at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very simple.
Okay. And Bob, quite the opposite, had a change in his life. He was an atheist, I think atheist.
I was raised Jewish, but liberal Jewish. When mm-hmm. There are many Jewish atheists, and I was one of them. So I was an atheist all the way up through my senior year in high school. And then I became an agnostic for a couple of years, became a little more open. and did not become a Christian until my second year of college.
Okay. Well, I would like to lay down a few ground rules today for our discussion on
rules.
Separation of church and state.
Wait a minute, Mark. You didn't tell us there were going to be rules here. Rules, whoa, check. No, go ahead.
I'm going to have squelch buttons on both of you guys.
Okay.
First, I will ask that each of you will refrain from interrupting one another and me. Two, by the way. And second, let's keep this dialogue and answer that we have as succinctly as possible, so not to impose any kind of artificial time restraints, but in fairness, the second responder will be given the same amount of time as the first used.
Okay. And you'll be watching the time because we'll probably
I'm try
be
to do
blabbering
that.
And not
this is going to be challenging.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Here go. Mark, I'm going to ask you the first question here.
Sure.
The first part of the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Could you explain that to our listeners?
It's very simple. It's known as the Establishment Clause from the word establishment. And it simply means that the concept that our Constitution was put up was to keep government and religion completely separate. And that means that it's very straightforward. Government should not impose any religion on people, and people should not impose a religion on the government.
Okay. Bob, from your point of view, what does the first part of the First Amendment say?
Well, the separation part we're adding in. The phrase separation between church and state was never used until Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptists. And it wasn't appropriate usage at the time. The Danbury Baptists of Connecticut were concerned. They felt that if the state was granting the right to be religious, that the state could also take it away. And they wanted Thomas Jefferson to affirm that the right was God-given, and Jefferson did that. He wrote to them, in, here's just a short quotation from the letter, "Believing with you that religion is a matter that lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." So there he's quoting what's in the Constitution. But now he goes on and says something that's actually not in the Constitution. He says, "Thus, building a wall of separation between church and state." People have kind of latched onto that. Well, you can latch back onto us when we get back. Mark, my friend, stay with us over the break because we do want to give you a chance to respond. You are listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Century.
You're listening to San Diego's family station, K-Praise. This is Cal Thomas. Stay tuned to Good News Talk Radio.
Celebrating 20 years on the air in San Diego.
Welcome back to our program. This is Bob Siegel and Sharon Cashard with our special guest, Mark Thomas. Mark is an atheist. We have deemed our program a sanctuary for atheists and skeptics, and we want people to be free to share their views here on the Bob Siegel Show. I had mentioned then that the whole phrase separation between church and state came from a letter from Thomas Jefferson where he was promising that the state would not interfere with the church. That did not mean that religion can't have anything to do with the government. For example, we open our Senate with prayer. We inaugurate the president by having him put his hand on the Bible. It meant that people that live in America are not going to be told that they have to be religious at all. They can be atheists. They can be of another religion. The founding fathers were very kind to Jews. And as somebody who grew up as a Jew, that's something that I really appreciate.
Okay, good answer. And Mark, you have about 2 minutes to respond to that.
Okay, Thomas Jefferson wrote the letter to the Danbury Baptists because they were very aware of what happens when a particular religion is not the favored religion. They wanted to be sure that the government was not setting up to have any sort of favored religion, including, from my perspective, any flavor of Christianity. So that was important. And simply, Thomas Jefferson, who was extremely critical in forming our government, created this wall of separation of church and state. And although it does not, of course, exist in the Constitution, it's still become a rather standard phrase for acknowledging how the Constitution was constructed. As a non-religious document, God is not mentioned in the Constitution, nor is any religion. The only place that it's mentioned, that religion is mentioned, is twice in Article 6, when it says that no religious test shall be required as qualification to any office, and then, of course, in the First Amendment.
Okay. Then I would like you to respond to this letter that he wrote to Benjamin Rush. The clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, had given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity through the United States. And as every sect believes its own form the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and they believe that any portion of power confided to me will be exerted in opposition to their schemes, and they believe rightly. So Jefferson, well, okay, just comment on that, would you, Mark?
Well, it seems to support my case. He was very, very explicitly stating that many people in many religious people at the time had hoped to gain control within the government. This was debated during the constitutional hearings when they created the Constitution, and the religious people lost. It was very carefully constructed as a secular government with no religious intrusion to give freedom to everybody to believe or not believe as they wished.
Okay, I share, Mark, I want you to know, I share your sentiment. I do not want to bring about a theocracy. You can always find some nut in some church somewhere who does, but most evangelical Christians are not trying to start a theocracy either. I think that's a misunderstanding. At the same time, I'd like to have clarification on what this establishment clause meant. Back in Europe, before people came over to America, different countries in Europe declared themselves to be Catholic or Protestant, or in some cases, what kind of Protestant, whether it's Lutheran, whether it's Reform, and we're simply saying we're not going to pick a denomination and we're not going to brand any denomination the official federal government. Interestingly enough, they weren't even telling states that they couldn't have what they wanted to call a state church, but even if a state wanted to designate a certain kind of Christianity, or even if we wanted to call ourselves a Christian nation, and I don't really care whether we call ourselves that or not, incidentally, but even if they wanted to, the purpose of the Establishment Clause was to say that you are not going to be forced to be a Christian, you're not going to be forced to be Jewish, you're not going to be forced to be any religion or any non-religion. It's not about saying that we can't ever mention religion outside of the church. And interestingly enough, if we wanted to talk about separation, I would be curious to know why the separation doesn't work both ways. We'll tell people that they can't bring up Jesus in the public school or on the college campus, but teachers will bring up Jesus, they'll claim he didn't exist, like this guy that's suing the Vatican, they'll put religion down, they'll teach evolution. Why doesn't the separation, assuming we even had it, why doesn't it work both ways would be a question I would ask.
Well, very carefully, the idea is to keep religion and government separate. That's not working to both ways, it's just keeping them separate. Teaching evolution is not any sort of religion. It's simply the secular view of how the world works. It's based on evidence. It's based on the best knowledge we have of the world and the universe at this time.
Would you be willing to allow somebody, a teacher, to say, on the other hand, there's another version called intelligent design? And
intelligent design is purely religious doctrine.
That
it has
is
no basis at all in any sort of evidentiary or science-based knowledge.
Mark, you're a nice guy, but what you said is simply not true.
It is.
The scientists that are talking about intelligent design are not talking about the Bible, but that's not even our debate. The point is, what I think I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm mistaken, and what I think I hear other atheists saying is that as long as we're talking about God as if he's a fantasy, that's fine. But the moment one wants to say, well, I believe God is real, then we get involved in circular reasoning. Reason one, well, God isn't real. Oh, well, I could claim that he is. Well, not in school, you can't, because that violates separation between church and state. Well, the Establishment Clause in the Constitution gave us the freedom to not have to be religious, but it didn't give us the freedom to never be offended. When somebody says, Mark, that they're offended because somebody's wearing a cross around their neck, how would you respond to that? I'm not saying that you would feel that way.
Yeah, that's false. I mean, people can obviously wear religious symbols. I can wear atheist symbols as I want. The problem is when any school, any public school, starts putting forth any sort of religious concepts, it's putting the imprimatur of government upon those concepts, and that is wrong for a separation of state and church.
Well, then would it also be wrong when they teach that God does not exist and that we got here through evolution? Would that be the government interfering with the free exercise thereof of religion?
Teaching evolution does not in any way state that God does not exist. It simply states, based on evidence, based on overwhelming evidence that we have, that evolution has occurred in the past, that we are descended as humans, we are descended from other primates, from hominids, and going all the way back hundreds of millions of years.
Well,
this is overwhelming.
I agree that one could believe in evolution and believe in God at the same time, and Charles Darwin did believe in evolution and God at the same time, but just to play the devil's advocate, if there was a Christian who did not believe that, and there are some teachers that will actually claim that God does not exist, would you agree then, Mark, that if we're really supposed to keep everything separate, that it's inappropriate for somebody to get up in a classroom and say God does not exist if they're not going to allow somebody to give the other side and say maybe he does?
Well, I don't think it's appropriate, especially in grade schools, for any teacher to take any position on religion because it's so inflammatory. As far as Darwin goes, Darwin classified himself as an agnostic. He had a very Christian, very strong, a wife who was very Christian. He realized it would cause her great distress if he were to come out as too much against religion, but he pretty much classified himself as an agnostic. Any sort of tales or stories of his deathbed conversions are completely wrong.
You're close, but only partly right. He became an agnostic late in his life because his daughter died, and he didn't understand that. It had nothing to do with evolution. He was actually a Christian when he wrote Origins of Species, but we'll continue to talk about atheism, about separation between church and state when we return. Stay with us over the break, Mark. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Electric.
Hi-fo.
Welcome back to our program. This is Bob Siegel and Sharon Cashard with our special guest, Mark Thomas. Mark is an atheist, and he's giving us his views on separation between church and state.
And you two just went off on a tangent of evolution. I'd like to give you, Mark, some time to respond to what Bob was saying before the break.
Well, we were talking, I mean, this is obviously a tangent. He was claiming that Darwin was a Christian. I have an undated quote by Darwin that very definitely shows that he was not a Christian, where he said, "I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true."
As you said, it's undated. He said that late in his life.
He was
going to a seminary for a while, and he never wrote Origins of Species to disprove the Bible, was my point. And he became an agnostic because he couldn't understand why God allowed his daughter to die. Now, that's a very fair question.
Yeah,
Mark.
That's true.
I don't blame him. I'm not even saying I blame him for feeling that way. And I was actually agreeing with you by bringing him up in the sense that you were claiming that believing in evolution is not necessarily mutually exclusive to believing in God. But my point was there are some professors that will claim that evolution is antithesis to believing in God. I believe you yourself believe that evolution disproves the existence of God.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay, you don't.
No, evolution itself does not disprove the existence
of God. Okay, well, I'm glad to hear you say that. So you are open? When we debated last time, you talked about God's non-existence as though it was a fact. Are you open to the possibility that God exists?
Which no, would make, but that's for other reasons.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. And Sharon, it's just aching to get us back on
I would
track
like to
here.
Get us back, but did you have anything else you wanted to say about that, Mark?
No, I think we need to get back to the separation
okay.
of government
okay.
and religion.
Okay. Okay, let me set up this next question. Jefferson believed that the government was to be powerless to interfere with religious expressions for a very simple reason. He had long witnessed the unhealthy tendency of government to encroach upon the free exercise of religion. And this he explained, I'm going to explain it in his own words, that he was writing to Noah Webster. It has become a universal and almost uncontroverted position in the several states that the purposes of society do not require a surrender of all our rights to our ordinary governors, and which experience has nevertheless proved they, the government, will be constantly encroaching on if submitted to them, that there are also certain fences which experience has proved particularly efficacious against wrong and rarely obstructive of right, which yet the governing powers have ever shown disposition to weaken and remove. Of the first kind, for instance, is freedom of religion. Let me repeat that. Of the first kind, for instance, is freedom of religion. So I find it interesting, Mark, that Jefferson chose the words freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. He fully anticipates a society in which citizens express their religiosity. Some of those same citizens make up the government as elected officials. They pass laws that serve the majority of their constituents. And you're holding a view that serves those who want to squelch any expression of religion in public life. You seem to want freedom from religion, not freedom of religion. Would you respond to that?
That is untrue. I acknowledge that for many people, if not most, religion is a very important part of their lives. But that the problem is that we're talking about is not people's expression of religion, it's government endorsement of religion, of any religion. And that therein lies the difference. I'm not against people expressing their ideas, but I am against government trying to put those ideas into our government and trying to say that somehow our government is based on Christianity or our government is based on a belief in God when it is not.
Okay, Bob, would you respond? Now, that was about a half a minute,
okay.
So that's all you're getting,
oh,
dude.
Boy. Well, it's true that our Constitution does not mention God except for those the two amendments that Mark referred to, or they mentioned religion. But it's also true that another document that was crucial to the establishment of our country, the Declaration of Independence, did mention God very clearly and mentioned that we were endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights. So the minute we start talking about human rights, one of the questions that would come up is, where do we get these rights from? I think all that's part and partial. The question that I would put to Mark, or to anybody listening, how would the government endorsing a religion be equated with forcing the religion? I used to go to school as an atheistic Jew. I was very aware that most of the people were Christians. I never went to catechism class. And although my parents did not have a problem with the Pledge of Allegiance, if my parents had had a problem with the Pledge of Allegiance, either because they don't believe in pledges to flags, or because they don't want to get up and say one nation under God, I wouldn't have had to do it. So I'm not claiming that we're a Christian nation, Mark, because I don't believe we are. The Puritans came over to start a Christian nation, but it was several hundred years or almost several hundred years later when we became a nation. No, we're not a Christian nation, but I don't have a problem with them opening in prayer. And if we are a democracy, and if there's a certain time in our history when most of the people in the democracy happen to be Christians and they want to see a manger scene in public or a cross up on Mount Soledad, I don't see how that is hurting anybody. What I keep hearing is, well, it offends me. I'm not hearing that from you personally, Mark, but that's what I'm hearing in all these cases that come before us. It offends me. And being free to not have to be religious doesn't mean you're free from not being offended. I hear people swear. I hear people take Jesus' name in vain all the time. I don't like listening to that, but I don't believe I have a constitutional right to not listen to that. It's not a right to not be offended.
Is there a question there?
Sure.
Please respond.
Bob, how would you feel if, for instance, at some point Islam became the majority religion in the United States and they decided to put a large Islamic symbol up on all the places, that suddenly prayers were named to Allah, beginning all government services, all the government functions? That is the point of separation of government and religion.
I understand that. I understand that you see that as the point, that it's about symbols. To me, the point, and I think it's pretty clear in the Constitution, is that I don't have to be a part of that religion. Now, you're asking a hypothetical question, so I can only give you a hypothetical answer. Hypothetically, if more people became Muslims, but it was run the way Christianity is being run today, in the sense that Christians in America are not forcing people, there is no law that forces anybody to be a Christian. There's no law, Mark, that forces you to be a Christian. There's no law that tells you can't speak out against it. You're on a Christian program. You're on a Christian radio station. No police are going to be waiting for you tonight because you came on the air. That would not happen in a Muslim country, incidentally. Now, hypothetically then, if the Muslims came into power but it was peaceful and they weren't forcing me to be a Muslim, would I like it? No. Would I think that something unconstitutional had happened? No. Now, if the Muslims came into power the way they normally come into power, they'd get rid of the Constitution and we'd have Sharia law. So that's why I said I could only give you a hypothetical answer to your hypothetical question.
Mark, would you like to respond?
No, I think we've established. I mean, the point is that the government is supposed to be kept separate. You know, very carefully, our government was not based on Christianity. You talked about where these rights come from. Let's go back a couple of points. You referred to the Declaration of Independence. First of all, the Declaration of Independence does not have anything to do with our government directly. It was written many years before the Constitution formed our government. It was a reasons for independence from Britain at the time. Secondly, the God that's referred to in the Declaration of Independence is not the Christian God. It's much more of a deistic creator type God that many people of the time referred to. They thought that God was necessary, the concept of a God was necessary for the creation of the universe.
Okay, let me respond to that. I assume you were going to ask me to respond.
Yes, go ahead.
That's true. They talk about God generally. It's not true that most of the forefathers were deists. Most of them were Christians. Some of them were deists. But that wouldn't even matter to me, Mark, because what's interesting, Mark, is I don't hear you or anybody else saying we can't use the word Jesus. I'm hearing people say we can't even use the word God in general. When we say one nation after God in the Pledge of Allegiance, we're not saying one nation after Jesus. So would you be okay with that because it's general? Because your whole argument about the Declaration of Independence was, oh, that was different. It was a general God. But then why argue against a general God in another platform?
Very carefully, because we are a nation that is not founded on any sort of God belief. It's very carefully in the Constitution separating God and religion specifically, any sort of religion, any reference to any God, whether it be Allah or Yahweh, the Christian God, or any other God. So very carefully set up a separation between government and religion. And that's the concept of it.
Well, okay, well, you've already agreed that the word separation is not actually in the Constitution, but getting back to the Declaration of Independence, that document was about the forming of a new nation. No, it's not our Constitution. Many of the framers of the Declaration of Independence were also the framers of the Constitution. And when they were writing the Constitution, we actually have their diaries. We know, we don't have to argue about what they meant with the Establishment Clause. We can read their diaries, and they make it very clear that all they're saying is there will not be a federal church named specifically, and nobody will be forced to become a Christian or any other religion. Now, if that's what it means, why do we have to then go add other things and say, well, I don't even want God mentioned in the classroom at all? How do you reconcile, Mark, the fact that our colleges in America were Bible colleges at the time, that even colleges that Thomas Jefferson founded himself had chapels, and he asked the students to go to chapel, even though his own Christianity and his own views of Christianity get very complicated when it comes to what his personal beliefs were. He certainly didn't have a problem with it being spread. Christianity in the Bible was taught in all of our schools at that time, so obviously keeping it completely separate from any public arena was not what our forefathers had in mind.
They very carefully, they noted that our government was not founded upon the Christian religion.
Well, no, it may not have been founded upon the Christian religion, but we still had Bible college. Okay, Mark, I apologize for the break. I do want to give you a chance to respond, and I promise I will stay with us. If you'd like to call in and chime in and ask Mark a question or ask me a question, 1-800-556-1210, 1-800-556-1210. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Celebrating 20 years on the air in San Diego.
Welcome back to our program. This is Bob Siegel and Sharon Fichard and my special guest, Mark Thomas. Mark, I want to thank you again for taking the time to come out here. You're a stand-up guy. You believe in debate. I think you and I could become friends. Okay, Sharon, you had some more questions for us.
Now, did we finish up with that last one?
I think I was saying something that we should give Mark a chance to respond to. That's correct. Go ahead, Mark.
I think we're missing out on, one of the basic concepts as far as why we have the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, so-called the Bill of Rights, was the concept of the tyranny of the majority that our founding fathers very wisely understood. That's why we don't have a pure democracy, we have a constitutional democracy, where the Constitution gives certain rights that the majority cannot take away from others. It took them all to sort this out. We no longer say that people can't have certain rights because they're the wrong gender or the wrong skin color. But I think eventually we've come down to where freedom really means something, and liberty really means something that you can't take away from somebody.
Well, can I say one thing about that?
Mm-hmm.
If 99% of the people want a certain thing, but 1% don't, and they get the Supreme Court to override what the elected Congress wants. And the Supreme Court says, yes, that's unconstitutional, then it doesn't matter that we have a democratic republic.
I'm not sure where you're going with that. Could you give an example?
Well, let me take a stab at this. Mark, I think there's some things that we agree on. Our forefathers did not want the country ruled by a mob. Okay, you're absolutely right about that. Mm-hmm. And a pure democracy has its problems. A pure republic has its problems. But wouldn't you agree that we see the extremism on both sides? It's true that we have a constitution, and if the majority wants to get it together and vote on something that's unconstitutional, that's a problem. But if we have a judge telling us what's constitutional and what isn't, if we have judges going back and reaching into one of Thomas Jefferson's letters and trying to get him to say something that he wasn't even really trying to say, then I think that becomes problematic as well.
Well, that is the function of the Supreme Court. It's you know, ever since Mayberry versus Madison, in that they have taken on the role of deciding what is constitutional, what is not.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Marbury versus Madison, because I know you're a fan of Thomas Jefferson, and before Marbury versus Madison, nobody believed that it was the purpose of the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution, and for a very good reason. There's no place in the Constitution where it says that. They're there to enforce the Constitution, and when Marbury versus Madison ruled and told Thomas Jefferson that he had to appoint some judges that had been set up by the previous administration, Adams, Jefferson said, let them enforce it, and they didn't enforce it. So Jefferson himself never even applied Marbury versus Madison, and yet we've developed this case law, and I think it becomes problematic when we go to the Supreme Court, because, Mark, you would agree that the Supreme Court, when they made the Dred Scott decision and claimed that was constitutional, was just totally out to lunch, right?
Of course. I mean, most people now agree. I'm not...
Right, so we can't appeal to them as an authority for all time. So that's just what I'm saying. So there's an extreme on the other side. We don't want a judicial tyranny. We certainly don't want a tyranny of the majority either. Right. The truth is somewhere in between, right?
That's why we have a three-tier government.
I agree.
Worked out, where we have three separate branches of government, each being controlled and controlling other branches.
I think we agree on that. I think some would argue that lately the Supreme Court feels it can keep overriding what the other branches do. 1-800-556-1210. Mart from San Bruno in the Bay Area, welcome to the Bob Siegel Show.
You didn't get him. You need to.
Hello?
Mart, welcome to the Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you. There's a point that I think that people are missing that you're both trying to make here, is that the separation of church and state isn't to oppress religion, it's to protect religion. The reason that they have the separation clause is so that religion is protected from the state, and the way it's protected is that if we prohibit the state, the government, from having a religious expression, then that protects it so that the people can have a religious expression.
Yeah, well,
that's the point that you're missing there.
No, well, I agree with you, Mart. I'm not sure we missed it. I don't know if you heard the whole program from the beginning, but I did mention that in the letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists, when he used the phrase separation, he was using it to assure the church that the government was not going to interfere. And I think the Establishment Clause says the same thing. The government shall not interfere with religion or its free exercise thereof. So I completely agree with you. I think my guest and I are disagreeing on that application of it. I think he's taking it more from the point of view that it's to protect the state from religion. I'm willing to say that it's to protect both from both. But what do you say, Mark? Would you think that simply because the state wants to put up a manger scene in public that follows, that somebody has to become a Christian against their will?
No, I think but that does put the imprimatur of government upon religion. I think very carefully the idea is to keep them separate. One of my favorite quotes actually is from Justice Harry Blackmun, Supreme Court Justice, where he said basically that a government cannot be premised on the belief that all persons are created equal when it asserts that God prefers some. And it asserts that when it puts forth any sort of religious doctrine, any sort of religious symbolism.
Okay, Mark, we want to give you a chance to respond to that. Do we have Mark back, Paul?
I'm here. I agree. But the thing that I think that Christians are confused about is that they think that the separation clause is anti-religious, and it's not anti-religious, it's pro-religious. It's an important protection that protects Christianity and Judaism, Muslims from the government intruding. So I am confused as to why the Christians are against the separation of church and state when it's the very thing that protects Christianity.
Yeah, well, I think I agree with you, but Mark's not seeing it exactly that way, are you, Mark?
Well, I'm just saying that it's to protect the people who are not necessarily of whatever favored religion the government may be trying to put forth, if it were.
Okay, well, Mark, thank you for calling in. I think that was an insightful comment that you gave us, and I hope you'll keep listening to our program. Thank you very much. And so, Mark, let me ask you a question. You're a citizen of America. You seem very concerned about this. In what way do you feel that we've been, whether it is a Christian country or not, I think I agree with you that we don't have to call it a Christian country, but it has been a country of majority of the people professing a belief in Christianity. It's been that way for over 200 years. You've been alive for a while now. I think you and I are about the same age or close to it. Where exactly have your personal civil liberties been violated?
Where have my personal civil liberties been violated?
Yeah.
Not directly. I just think that it is wrong for government to mix religion in with its functionality. Obviously, it's not going to affect my day-to-day life if the government decides to put up a manger scene, but that's just intrinsically wrong. It violates both the spirit and the letter of the Constitution.
Okay, now, exactly how? The Constitution says Congress shall make no law prohibiting the exercise of religion. So somebody now exercises religion, puts up a manger scene. I used to look at manger scenes as an atheistic Jew. I didn't believe in it, Mark. I was not even as kind to Christianity as you are. And you're not always that kind to it, but I wasn't even as kind as you. But I looked at that and I said, if people want to be stupid enough to believe that that baby is the Son of God, who cares? I didn't give a hang. It wasn't an issue to me. I'm saying this honestly. When I was a true atheist like you, it didn't matter. And I'm trying to understand, and I believe me, I'm asking this sincerely. Whose rights are being violated by that thing?
People can put up all the manger scenes. They can have whatever beliefs they want. They can do this in their homes. They can do this in the yards. They can do this in their churches. They're perfectly free to. It's a free nation. The problem comes in, which is the focus of this discussion, when government puts its imprimatur of religion by putting forth any sort of religious doctrine.
Okay, let me give you a test case, because I was looking at your website recently, and I noticed, and I may be mistaken, it was either your website or the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which your website, your Silicon Valley Atheist website, links to. But
yeah,
one of them mentioned that Phil Paulson, the atheist Phil Paulson, who's been a guest on my program and who I've debated before, was given an award. Now, I don't know how much you've followed the Mount Soledad case, but originally that was paid for by the government because they viewed it as a war memorial. But when Phil started making an issue out of it, people offered to buy it as private property, and Phil's response was that it's still up on the hill and people still have to see it. So would you disagree with Phil on that point? Sounds like you wouldn't be all that bent out of shape with it being on the hill as long as it wasn't paid for by the government.
Well, I think it's wrong in that people think it's part of the government.
Okay, so it's now we've got
having churches, having crosses, of course, that's acceptable.
Okay, so now we're worried about what people are thinking when they see it. Let's hold that thought, my friend. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Welcome back to our program. Mark, we're down to our last segment, and the time goes by quickly. We're going to continue talking, give you a chance to respond to what we were saying. But let me at this time, because we'll be right in the middle of something, and we'll have to leave quickly. I know we could have taken another 2 hours. Thank you, my friend, so much for joining us. I do hope you'll come back. You are always welcome as a guest on my program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, what we were talking about before the break, the cross of Mount Soledad, any more you want to say about that before Sharon asks her next question?
No, I just think that by the solution was to sell off a very small parcel of land and say that that's no longer government property. I think that's sidestepping the law. I think that violates very much the spirit of the law.
Well, but if somebody wanted to buy it, and you were finally resting, your case was, well, somebody might look at it and think it's the government. I don't think the forefathers were too worried about what people might think. I think they were just worried that somebody would be forced to be religious against their will. And, you know, I don't wear a cross around my neck. I could care less whether we have a cross up on Mount Soledad or not, but when I see people making such an issue out of it, and my friend Phil even got an award for it, I just had to wonder. Well, Sharon has another question. I think she wants to put me on the spot
now.
Go ahead. You want to play the devil's advocate with me now?
Yes. The Pledge of Allegiance has been under attack recently because the words "under God" were added in 1954 by President Eisenhower, who stated at the time, "In this way, we are affirming the transcendence of religious faith in America's heritage and future. In this way, we shall constantly strengthen those spiritual weapons which forever will be our country's most powerful resource in peace and war." The debate is whether the words "under God" have a constitutional right to remain in the pledge. How would you defend that right for "under God" to remain in the pledge, Bob?
Good one, Ike. If you could only turn in your grave with all the misery you're causing us over that. It's true that that wasn't originally in the pledge. It's true that there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to say a Pledge of Allegiance at all. That was added in later. I could care less whether we say a Pledge of Allegiance. I could care less whether we have the word "God" in there. We're not one nation united under God. We have people in this country that don't believe in God. We have people in this country that believe in different gods, and I don't believe that different religions are all believing in the same God, and I don't think Mark does either. At the same time, here's the bottom line. If somebody doesn't want to make the pledge or wants to sit down during that time, they have a constitutional right to do that. So no, there's no constitutional enforcement of the pledge, but there's certainly nothing in our Constitution that says they can't put that in the pledge. So I guess I'm taking the "what's the big deal" approach here.
Okay, Mark?
Bob, apparently you've forgotten how tough it is in grade school. Kids there don't have the philosophical or mental background to be able to stand up to that. There's what's known as prayer bullying, as religious bullying. Any kid who is willing to be different for something like that is going to be ostracized. That's the reality of it. Once again, you started out where we agree that under God, it seemed that you agreed that under God should not be in the Pledge of Allegiance.
No, I didn't say it should not be. I said that, it was added in later, and I said that the bottom line is if a parent doesn't want their kid making that pledge, they can tell them to sit down. And look, Mark, I went to school when they used to have catechism. It was public school. They used to take kids out for catechism. I was one of the few that didn't go. I didn't care. I didn't see any bullying. And you've told me yourself that your own rights haven't been infringed. Isn't it possible? And I know you're saying this sincerely, and I do respect that, Mark, but isn't it possible that we're setting up some straw men and creating a problem that maybe doesn't even exist? If you want
it exists to a great degree. I've read articles by kids who are very conflicted. They don't believe in any sort of a God. They think it's wrong to state this every day. And yet, they know that if, you know, kids can be really brutal. They can be very tough on anybody who's different. I'm sure you,
that applies to everything. That applies to kids. Will bully, kids will call names. We don't have a right in the Constitution to not be offended and to not feel intimidated. I'm not justifying that, but kids will do that, not only about religion, but we'd have to then outlaw the 500 other things that kids will intimidate each other.
No, but that gives them a very great experience, a very, very great reason to bully other kids. And religion, historically, for adults and for kids, has been a very strong religion. Now, obviously, you know that how many people have been killed in the name of religion.
Yes, but with Christianity, we always have to go back a long time to the Crusades and things like that. In the last 100 years...
Not at all. Holocaust was largely religious.
The Holocaust was started by Adolf Hitler, who was an atheist, who was a follower of Friedrich Nietzsche. And Mark, we'll have to carry this on next time. Thank you, my friend. Everybody else, you're always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too.
The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by ProBuild.